Welcome to the Riding Unicorns podcast. This is the podcast all about uncovering what it takes to build a unicorn business. I'm James Pringle. I'm a VC at Portfolio Ventures. My co-host is Hector Mason. Hector is a B2B investor at Episode One Ventures. This episode is with Kirsty Grant, Managing Director at Cedars. Cedars is Europe's leading online private investing platform that enables individuals to invest in startups, growth companies, and if eligible, top VC funds. We get an update on the state of crowdfunding, where the market is heading, and learn more about what really drives success for seeders and investors on the platform. Let's get started. Hi, Kirsty. Welcome to the Rider Unicorns podcast. It's great to have you on.
Hi, James. Hi, Hector. Thanks very much for having me.
So, Kirsty, maybe we could just start with the official explanation of what Cedars is today and your role at the company.
Absolutely. So Cedars is a private equity investment platform. We're most widely known for our equity crowdfunding platform, which essentially allows retail investors to invest into high-growth companies from across Europe. But we also operate a secondary market for privately held shares. We provide access for investors into VC funds and sort of infrastructure for VCs raising capital alongside a bunch of sort of other equity-esque type products. And as of last year, we became part of the Republic Group. So we're now the largest global platform of our kind with 2.5 million members. And as we become regulated in Europe, we will be, in the coming months, we'll be the first that's able to offer that fundraising capabilities across UK, Europe, and the US. In terms of my role, I'm currently managing director of the Europe UK business. I started life as investment director at Cedars and then chief investment officer and took over as managing director at the end of last year.
Fantastic. We're looking forward to getting into the weeds of what you guys do and the market and all these good things. But you've had a fairly non-typical route to where you are today. And so I'd love to just hear kind of, you know, how you think about that route and where you started and why you've ended up where you are.
Yeah, absolutely. So started life in Western Australia, which is not exactly known as a hub of tech and innovation, and certainly started my career as a corporate lawyer. Again, often lacking in innovation, trained in Australia. I worked in Singapore for a few years and before eventually landing in London at Freshfield in the city as an M&A lawyer. Yeah, and yeah, that is, I guess, a relatively unusual route into then venture. I never imagined myself becoming a lawyer, but I really enjoyed it for many years until I didn't. But I enjoyed M&A. What I enjoyed about it was kind of getting to know companies. That was always the most interesting part of the role was sort of you had this very intense period where you had to really get to know a business, understand it in and out, understand the market it operated in. And you always found out all sort of fascinating details about the industry. Doing a cod oil production company and you find out where the best at, you know, cod or anchovy, the found, et cetera, in the world. And I enjoyed the negotiations, the kind of dance, pressure, excitement of getting the deal done. But I think the truth is that, you know, most M&A activity at that level, at that sort of super high end of the market, big value M&A, you're sort of just moving assets around the same bucket. You're not really creating much value. And between that and that sort of realization and the sort of grueling hours kind of drove me out. And Cedars was the sort of the perfect antidote to that.
Yeah. And then there must be a load of benefits from having a legal background, but which do you see being the main ones?
That's a good question. I mean, the work ethic that working at big law firms like that instills in you from early on is definitely a huge value. And you see that amongst lots of lawyers who then move into other areas. I think that the Cedars business model really suited my skills. You know, at the heart of what we're doing, kind of bringing together legal structuring, deal structuring and ideas. You're trying to make them, but you're sort of, you're adding in tech, adding in like a beautiful product on top of that to try and make these transactions happen, but at scale, you know, make them as efficient as possible so that you can make it feasible to do these small investments eventually and aggregate small investments into something that's really meaningful, a meaningful amount of money for a founder. That grounding has been beneficial. One of the parts of the job I really love is when we're working on new products and I'm applying that kind of legal structuring knowledge to kind of create something and launch it into the market.
It's really interesting because I think, I don't know, I kind of have this interest in how lawyers' minds work. You need to be right in the weeds, right in the detail. And it's not so much how my mind works. And so I'm glad there are people whose minds do work like that. I wonder if you can, you know, just myth bust, you know, are lawyers cut out for being founders and leaders, or actually do they typically stay in the roles where they have to be incredibly detailed and, you know, reading documents late into the night?
Yeah, look, it's a great question. And I'm not the founder of Cedars, but our founder is a lawyer, was a corporate lawyer by background as well. So I do believe that we can cross the pond and be more creative. You know, one of the things is, like with all founders, you know, you just have to, it takes the right sort of person. And I don't think having a legal training and a legal mind precludes you from being the kind of person that can innovate and lead a business. One of the big parts of it is the change in mindset, though. You know, I think back to, I worked in a lot of different jurisdictions and, you know, landing in London in a big firm like Freshfields, you are really thrown in and you're trying to do these big transactions in a market that you don't know, with new rules and laws and regulation that you don't yet know. And, you know, I always had this slightly lazy lawyer trick of sort of when a client asks you, can I do X? I would think, well, looking in the market, is anyone else doing that, their deals that way? Is anyone else doing that thing? And if they're not, there's probably a good reason why they're not. And you can then kind of work backwards and find the law that says you're not allowed to do that. And, you know, that is helpful. But if I kind of continued that way, I don't think I would have been successful at Cedars. You know, we have to think like, you know, if there's no one in the market doing it, then frankly, that's a huge opportunity for us. And sure, you have to ask yourself, why is no one doing it? Is there a reason? And work through all the issues. But you've got to be willing to be like, no, we're going to innovate in this area and push ourselves to do this thing that no one else is.
Right. Okay. So the mistake I've made is in thinking that lawyers are not creative. And actually, of course, you know, of course, there's a subset of lawyers who are very creative.
Absolutely. And you're right. You know, you part of your job as a lawyer is to point out risks, right? But it's just finding the kind of lawyers who are able to kind of point out the risk, contextualize it, quantify it, and kind of move on and be willing to risk take and moving into that world of being like, I understand it. I see it. I'm happy to move past it.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. For sure. Kirsty, I'm keen to dive in just to sort of give some context to listeners on, you know, what we're going to spend the bulk of today talking about, which is really crowdfunding as a whole. And I would love just to hear your view on where crowdfunding has come from, you know, when it kind of emerged maybe 10 years ago, where we are at now, like what's sort of changed and what's exciting about the next 5 or 10 years of crowdfunding, really, because it's come from being a real nascent industry to actually being quite established. But there must have been all sorts of obstacles and dynamics that have changed and regulation that's changed and all these things. So it would be great to get a sort of timeline of how you see crowdfunding.
So Cedars launched just over 10 years ago and really rode that wave post-financial crisis, where, you know, there were a lot of fintech, particularly in the UK, launching new products and challenging kind of incumbent financial institutions who had somewhat sort of lost the trust of consumers. And then you saw that wave of peer-to-peer lending platforms that really paved the way for something like this. And then you had Jeff and Carlos, our founders, thinking that they could do it with equity. It was definitely a slightly, I think, it's a more complex product than something like debt. It probably took longer for people to understand and longer for the consumers on both sides, both investors and founders, to really understand the product and its benefits and for it to gain the kind of headlines that some of the sort of peer-to-peer lending platforms did in the early days. But since then, I think we've made really good headway as an industry, as you say, becoming sort of quite part of the establishment a little bit of, at least I think amongst the sort of founder and startup sort of founder ecosystem. And we're kind of in the minds of founders, I think, particularly in the UK. And you can see that in the kind of caliber of companies that sort of raised on Cedars now and the number of exits that we've had as well. So that's been really, I think, really helpful in sort of delivering profits back to investors from the likes of some secondary opportunities that we've given in the likes of Revolut to really small companies like Centre that have had like, I don't know, 120x returns for investors. That sort of has proven that the model works, I think, and perhaps finally, at least some of the naysayers. But in many ways, I think it's really still very early in the evolution of the industry. As I said, I think if you're in the community, you know about it. You've heard of, if you're a founder, you have heard about equity crowdfunding. You have probably at least considered it at some point in time. You know, we are the most active investor in private companies in the UK, have been for the last couple of years. So I think we have earned our place at the table in that sense. But on the investor side, I think we're still really early on in the awareness and sort of a change of behavior. I think over the last couple of years, I'd say sort of 2020, you sort of started to see retail investor behavior start to change. And I think that's been driven in part the likes of, sort of, you know, Robin Hood or on our side of the pond, Bucks and Lightyear in Europe, creating a free trade, you know, creating this new class of retail investors who are, you know, looking to directly invest into equity. Like, I think in the UK, they say it's still only about 17% of the population that invest in stocks. And we're talking public stocks here. So there's, and it's closer to 60% in the US. So if we can continue to drive that awareness and behavior of retail investors into public stocks, and then I think they will, savvy ones, into the private capital markets, then I think we'll be able to, we've still got a lot of room to grow in terms of adoption.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. So I'm a huge advocate for investing in private markets and particularly early stage startups, and want that investing to be democratized. And so I love what you guys are doing and what all of the other players are doing. And there's a huge trend towards getting retail into this market. But it feels like, you know, 2020 was huge. 2021 was huge for that, you know, the explosion of retail investment of all kinds. But it just feels like something needs to happen to unlock the sort of the mass market. You know, we're still talking about the kind of maybe some sophisticated investors, but a lot of kind of people are sitting around on Reddit. How do we get to the mass market? The people who are currently investing on Nutmeg and on Hobby Lansdowne and who use asset managers and stockbrokers. Yeah, how do we get these people investing in private markets? Or is it an age thing, or is it something else that we haven't thought about?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, you know, we always think we could be doing a better job at getting the word out there. Absolutely. That's very much on us and for us to spread that. I think there are different ways of attracting investors that different sort of that are in different sort of age brackets, et cetera. I think in the early days, a lot of our investor profiles skewed to the older, the sort of 35 plus, the kind of, you know, mass affluent, classic kind of lawyer, accountant, dentist, et cetera. But I think our fastest growing segment is certainly the younger investors who are, I think, incredibly savvy. They are the ones that know the sort of the first movers when these new products come to market, the first adopters of the new technology, new business model, et cetera, and having the ability to then make them investors into the businesses that they're following and using is obviously a big part of the power of equity crowdfunding. I think you're right that there is more that could be done in terms of tying up the value chain. So certainly we've started to make some moves in that in terms of offering different products that might appeal to a different type of investor, whether it be that sort of aggregated capital, like access to venture funds. We've toyed with auto invest, so the idea of kind of creating a passive portfolio in this asset class. All those aspects that which will sort of, I think, bring different types of investors to this asset class.
Yeah, Kirsty, so maybe we could double down on that a little bit. So in the public markets, the biggest asset managers in the world, sort of BlackRock and Vanguard, have mainly grown through kind of baskets of ETFs and things like that. And solo stock picking, well, all investing carries some risk, but solo stock picking, whether it's public or private, is obviously riskier than having a diversified portfolio. So can you maybe talk a little bit about how investing in a fund product or a passive basket product could maybe actually increase the adoption to a broader audience, and what Cedar's product looks like for that?
Yeah, happy to. So I'll touch on a couple of the sort of basket type products that we have previously sort of worked with. We had an auto invest feature where you sets it at the amount you kind of want to invest on a monthly basis, and you can pick the criteria that you want it to deploy into. We also launched our own EIS 100 fund, where again, the idea was you sort of make one investment decision and it gets deployed into all businesses that meet that criteria across the platform over sort of a 12-month period, all being EIS eligible, and you sort of one decision gets you that diversified basis. We're sort of supporting that we're always supporting that thesis by publishing all our portfolio data, and we'll be coming out with a portfolio report later in this year as well. And that the numbers work, you know, when we look at the performance of the portfolio as a whole, it's in that last report, it was 14 or 15% IRR, and it jumped up to 20% with sort of tax reliefs baked in. But then when you specifically looked at the segment of our investors who are building portfolios of you know, 20 plus businesses, the results were even more dramatic. You know, they were just getting even better returns than the kind of portfolio as a whole. So we've got the data that now sort of supports that thesis, and, you know, would encourage, you know, encouraging investors to kind of build up a diversified thesis like that. And then, as you say, we've started to offer products that allow them access to sort of managed funds. So venture capital funds being where we've started. And this is one of the products I'm probably the most proud of, because it's really taken off. It's unique still in the market, and it's true to our mission. You know, we're sort of giving our investor base access to an asset class they wouldn't otherwise have, but it's also creating a community of venture investors and enthusiasts to support our things, sort of bringing them to the platform to support our founders long term. We started that product a few years ago, almost by chance, first working with Seedcamp, just to find a way that they could utilize our infrastructure, both our sort of our tech and financial and legal structuring and infrastructure, to allow them to conveniently bring in their network into their fourth fund. So at that point, they were looking to bring in, you know, founders from their earlier funds and enable them to invest in the future Seedcamp funds, but at a lower ticket size than what they would have normally set for their LPs. And then what we realized was that with a little work, that product could kind of go a lot further and be applied in to all venture funds, really. And so then a couple of years ago, we raised an allocation in Passion Capital's last fund. Eileen was the first to sort of open up her funds more broadly to our investors on the platform. Jandra were very successful in raising funds off the back of their mission, which was to really diversify their investor base and build up a community that their portfolio of companies could then tap into. And then this year, we've just actually, in a couple of months ago, closed Seedcamp's funds, which was the third that they've done with us. So yeah, it's one of those products that's a success in its own right, but which also, I think, benefits our core products and deepens that core of investors that are frequenting the platform.
How do you think about all these different products that you offer, or all of the investments that you offer? You know, you have, like, you're giving people access to, I don't know if you've ever had an EIS fund that you've actually offered access to, because you have your own robo investing in EIS, you have access to Seedcamp. Maybe you'd have a way to access a third-party EIS fund. Do you ever, strategically, do you ever think about the tension between those, whether they're going to, you know, cannibalize your own robo-investment feature, or is it kind of, you guys are the infrastructure, you're not giving the advice, you're presenting the opportunities?
Yeah, we definitely see ourselves as presenting the opportunities rather than advising. And so far, I've seen nothing but benefits of being able to provide all of these different types of products. They all sort of offer exposure to roughly the same asset class, you know, early and growth stage companies, but absolutely in different ways. And I think it's an important part of the model to offer that. You know, with something like a Hambro Perks or a Passion Capital fund on there, you are getting access to fund managers and their expertise. You're getting access to their deal flow as well, which, you know, we wouldn't necessarily always be able to get onto the platform. We're getting there, and hopefully one day everyone will be able to get direct access via CEDARS. But, you know, obviously, that you guys well know, your deal flow is a really important part of what you do, and being able to offer our investors access that is, you know, we're really happy about. In terms of that, do we think it cannibalizes? No, we tend not to see that. You know, when we have lots of things on offer on the platform, it brings more activity, you know, and so we don't see it as being competitive quite in that way. You know, we're often careful about what's on at the same time and things like that. But in general, we've found more and a variety of more products as being beneficial.
So this might be a touchy one, but, like, there are two clear major players in the UK, right? CEDARS and CrowdCube. And there was the potential merger that didn't end up going through. I mean, can we stop by just talking about the merger and how it came about? What was the rationale and what happened?
Yeah, sure. So it became clear that, I think, to both of us, I guess, that to continue to progress on the sort of relatively similar missions, I guess, that we have, you know, and to create the kind of depths of the platform and product and reach that we believed was essential, we had to reach a certain scale. And, you know, at the time, I think a sort of UK merger made sense. But as you say, it didn't proceed thanks to the competition authorities. But in the meantime, though, while that was sort of happening, a few things really went in our favor. So, you know, crowdfunding kind of took off in the US. He had been around for a little while. They were a bit behind the UK. UK's really led it, but regulation over a series of those Jobs Act titles got slightly better and slightly better. And certainly around 2020, it's really started to take off. And Republic in particular really started to strengthen. Equally, the European crowdfunding regulation came into force, somewhat delayed as well, but they introduced that 18 months ago to provide that unified regime under which you could offer up platforms like ours across Europe. And so now there was a clear way to reach the scale and the reach that we were talking about and that we all had in mind, but now across geographies rather than, I think, just within the UK. So fairly quickly after one merger was off, we were in discussions with Republic, and that transaction made a lot of sense. We're very aligned on mission. And as I said, it's sort of allowing us to now be that first global platform.
And Kirsty, what does a crowdfunding platform focus on when it comes to growth? Is it number of users, number of active users, total investment per month, companies that you list? I mean, I'm sure you measure all of those, but where do you guys really try and think to optimize when it comes to product and marketing and growth?
Yeah, I mean, that's the complex thing when you're running a marketplace, right? You know, where do you focus? What side of the marketplace are you going to invest in growing or invest into new products to support, and trying to constantly kind of find that balance with sort of limited time, resources, et cetera, to be building? We absolutely focus on number of companies we're raising, the amount that they are raising. Ultimately, that is our product, is the amount of capital we are able to deliver to founders. So that is one of the kind of number one metrics for us. On the other side, absolutely, we are focused on growing investor numbers, but we are more focused on the number of repeat investors that we have and active investors we have than we are on sort of the headline numbers. The headline number is great, but it's often representative of, you know, you have a big, flashy brand campaign, come and raise. There's a bunch of fans who we want to put in, you know, £10, but aren't necessarily there to sort of invest long term. They're still great, and we know a lot of them will convert into repeat investors on Seeders, but it's then our job to make sure we convert them to those repeat investors. And a big part of that is educating them about the piece, providing other products that they are going to engage with, and providing new businesses and exciting investment opportunities that are going to get them to part with their money again.
So Kirsty, we're just going to use this opportunity to ask you one of our repeat questions, which is three bits of actionable advice in 60 seconds, roughly. What would those be?
Sure. So I think one, given the legal background and the questions at the start there, would probably be about becoming good at managing your legal counsel. You made some really good points at the start there about how people can get a bit carried away or a bit, you know, lack understanding when it comes to legal matters or get scared of it. But becoming too deferential to your legal counsel, it will kill your deals, you know. So I would recommend three things on that front. If you're ever working on a transaction and you've got external counsel, have a frank conversation with them at the start and explain what is deal critical to you, what you're trying to get out of the transaction, and what is just not important. And they should be able to help in that conversation and come to you with things that they think might be important, and you can just roll them out from the start. Be clear about the timeframes for the deal and the impact of the timeframes flipping, and try and put dollars on it, you know, and that way if an issue comes up that could, you know, they're kind of tossing up whether you delve back into negotiations for another week to fight out some issue, or you just sort of let it pass, then at least you've got something to weigh that against and a frame to make that decision and just decide, you know what, the cost of the delay is bigger. Let's move forward and get the deal done. And then always ask them to be clear about how big a risk is. I think I touched on this at the start as well. As I said, it is their job to point out the risks and to try and save you from them. But if they just give you a list of risks without context, then just not doing their job. You are entitled to ask them, you know, how big is the risk? Or even, you know, what would you do? They might not give you a clear-cut categoric answer, but if they're unable to give you a clear answer that gives you the information you need to make that decision, then you should find new legal counsel, frankly. Outside of legal counsel, managing your lawyers, I'd say, this is what I see in founders all the time, but if you're intending to reinvent the wheel, please be able to explain why. You know, innovation for innovation's sake, I think, always kills me. I'm obviously very supportive of people who want to try something different and break with how incumbents are doing something. That's great, but only if you understand why and why it's going to deliver benefit to do it differently, and have at least asked around and had that conversation as to, have you tried this before and why didn't it work? Have I got any time left? If the 60 seconds, the only one, another one would be like, wear sunscreen.
It's good advice. That, I mean, it boils down to product thinking and being close to your customer. Like, you've got to, like, building technology for technology's sake is pointless. And like, you know, sometimes people just see something new and shiny and they're drawn to it and they want to build. And, you know, there's sort of a tool that looks cool and they think it will have some nice functionality, but it's got to solve a problem. You see the best companies running these experiments and reinventing the wheel where the wheel's broken repeatedly and they're experts at spotting opportunities and building solutions for them. And you also see companies that experiment for experimentation's sake and they waste so much resource on it. And I think that really can be the difference between success and failure for a company in the long run.
Yeah, 100%. Like, that kind of adage of the move fast, break things thing is great, but has perhaps gone to the head of too many a founder. And that sort of continuing to try to break things that frankly aren't broken, it gets people just sort of in a spiral of not producing anything of value. And you see it both in terms of, you know, what they're producing, the product that or service that they're trying to put into the market. But you also see it sort of behind the scenes and sort of trying to take an innovative approach to their cap table or an innovative approach to, you know, the relationship they're going to have with employees and how they manage them. And sometimes it's just like trying to try too many new things at once that can send people down the wrong path.
Yeah, I just wanted to follow up. I was going to say, all founders try and shoehorn new technology into a business. So like blockchain or AI is the current one. It's like, this industry needs AI. Well, it does it always, or is that just like a feature that existing businesses can use? Or like, oh, we're going to put, you know, tickets on the blockchain. And it's like, does that actually solve a problem? Yeah, okay, it might sound like some cool tech, but doesn't always solve the problem. And I think investors, we're sort of guilty of almost encouraging that behavior and then quite quick to shut it down as well, because we know sort of what we're looking for. But we obviously use these buzzwords in our own kind of fundraising and websites and things like that. And then founders reach out to us and we sort of say no to them.
I think like a good VC isn't going to be advising companies to like run with bad ideas. But I think there's the message from the market is that VC is investing in generative AI.
Yeah.
So while like there's a lot more nuance to that on a VC by VC basis and in the way that VCs are advising their companies to use generative AI, the message that founders are hearing, unless you dig into it, is, oh shit, we need to build generative AI because that's where everyone's investing it. But there's so much more nuance to it.
100%.
Yeah, it's kind of like leading with the technology you're using rather than the solution, right? And that's what I always feel somewhat about blockchain companies, and they say we're a blockchain something or other. I'm sort of like, I don't kind of go around talking about that we're a Ruby Rails platform. Like, it just is. It's just, you know, these days, I think with AI, you're starting to see the same thing. Like, some businesses are AI businesses, like they're coming up with a solution and you get that. But for the rest of us, it's just another piece of technology that we're trying to use to make whatever we do more efficient.
Yeah, definitely. We like to wrap up our shows with our dinner party guest game. So if you were to have dinner with any three people, who would they be?
A really good question. I really thought about it in the context of an actual dinner party. You know, we love to have dinner parties. And so it was very much like, who's going to be good fun to sit around and have open a few bottles of wine with? And with that criteria in mind, I think first would be Nick Cave. He's an incredible musician, Australian, obviously, which helps, an incredible writer, and in so many different contexts, you know, screen, poetry, lyrics, of course. He's got this great newsletter that I recommend that you subscribe to if you don't already, where he answers fan questions and does so with such sort of eloquence and empathy, I think. And despite all that sort of darkness and sort of somewhat heavy poetics, I believe he's got a wicked sense of humor, doesn't seem to take himself too seriously. And I have this fantasy that like at the end of the dinner party, we'd all end up around the piano with him sort of serenading us, me and the other guests. Painting the picture. Next up would be Sarah Blakely, the founder of Spanx. I just love her founder story of bootstrapping that business all the way through to, I think it was Blackstone sort of taking over, essentially. or certainly taking the majority stakes. So never taking external capital before that. A bit perverse, I guess, given I'm in the business of fundraising, to be so enamored with entrepreneurs who don't take on external capital. But I don't know, it speaks to me of something. I think we have standardized what we expect of startups so much in our industry in terms of kind of what metrics they should be hitting at what stage and how they should move through the sort of Series A, Series B, Series D fundraise process, which in my moments of existential crisis are where it doesn't leave room for businesses that don't fit that mold. And so it's great to see a founder kind of make her own way, I guess, and do it.
Absolutely. I think that's interesting. Yeah, I wonder if there's a kind of, there's a trend there, because I think a lot of VCs and people who work in this space have this like disproportionate respect for bootstrap. And I think this is just a sort of passing thought, but maybe we're all so keen on people who do things differently and break the mold. And what become normal is to go down the normal path of raising venture money, that we now all kind of love these people who don't take that normal route. But so maybe it's cyclical. We'll come back to the point where all of the VCs are loving the founders who do take the normal route.
Maybe. It does sort of speak to that slightly more romantic story, doesn't it, of a founder who just wants to build their business because they kind of have so much conviction about the idea and the product, as opposed to kind of, I've got this plan to become a unicorn in 3 years and these are the steps I'm going to go to get there. So I think it just harks back to that somewhat romantic story. But, you know, equally, I guess I'm aware that that assumes a certain level of privilege that you can do that, that you have the means with which to start and potentially take a low salary and all those things to get your business to that stage. So, yeah, with a pinch of salt. But I would like, she seems like she'd be good too, good fun as well, Sarah Blakely. So I'd like to have her at my dinner party. Sorry, final guest, another writer, actually, Elena Ferrante, or rather the author whose pen name is Elena Ferrante. She's, that would obviously be a huge scoop for me, as she's largely kept her identity a secret and I'd get to find out who she is. But that's not the only reason. I really loved her series of novels. They're called the Neapolitan series of novels, which follow the lives of these two women from when they're very young girls in Naples and their sort of friendship throughout their life, somewhat sometimes tense friendship. And I just think her sort of rendering of their internal life and that female friendship is really powerful. And she's created such a deep fictional world that I have so many questions about. You know, I think I'd get there and be like, and then what happened to so-and-so? And what about on, you know, when so-and-so was here, what, you know, I've just got so many other questions about that world. But I have no idea whether she would be any fun because she barely did interviews. But I think that someone that writes about the human experience like that has to have at least a level of humor and empathy.
Well, Kirsty, great guest. Thank you so much for doing it. It's really great to see Cedars developing and offering new products and aligning so well with our own mission, which is to try and educate and inspire people to get involved in this amazing world of private market investing that can unlock so much good and potential and things like that. So thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
That's it for this week. Thanks very much for listening. To stay up to date with the latest episodes, please follow or subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. We also have a newsletter called Reading Unicorns, which is another great way to get every episode direct to your inbox. Please tell your friends about it and engage with us on social media. We'll see you on the next episode.